The age of pilotless vehicles is here and has been for a while. Science fiction got us used to the idea of robots and cars without drivers. Now we have those things and flying machines that require no pilot, at least no pilot on board. It stands to reason that if we have pilotless vehicles on land and in the air, we can have them in the sea too, and we do. Ocean-going drones exist and are hard at work in many parts of the world. Their makers and operators prefer the term AUV, Autonomous Underwater Vehicle. Some of them come from the Sea Glider program at the University of Washington School of Oceanography. That's where Dr. Fritz Starr is the manager of the Sea Glider Fabrication Center. Dr. Starr, welcome to the exchange.
Well, good morning. Thank you.
It's good to have you here. I should point out, too, that Dr. Starr is giving a lecture about this very subject tomorrow night at 7 at the Hale Center at Southwestern Oregon Community College in Coos Bay. Dr. Starr, how long have AUVs been around?
Well, I would say that this really dates back to the early 90s, but certainly by the end of the 90s and the early 2000s, they were becoming a reality that people could use on a regular basis, scientists could use on a regular basis. It's very interesting. I just went to a meeting last week in which lots of talks were given and in which glider data was presented. And nowadays, people don't even really need to talk about how that data was collected. It is, these vehicles are so ubiquitous. And that really wasn't true at the same meeting I went to 10 years ago. So.
Really, they've just proliferated that quickly.
Yeah, it's been quite remarkable how many places in the world's oceans these are excellent for collecting data. It's you know, one of those I guess clearly a good idea.
So it's almost like having your own fish do research for you, from the sounds of it, the way these things work.
Sort of. You get to, you know, pick the location where you're going to launch them. They have the ability to go where you direct them. Every time they come to the surface, they send their data back. So even if the vehicle is lost midway through the mission, you at least have all the data. And that, for at least us in the science world, is the critical thing.
Now, I noticed that there's a major difference with airborne drones. Nobody actually pilots these remotely?
Sort of. While they're underwater, there's absolutely no connection to an operator. They operate entirely on their own software. When they come to the surface, they exchange files with a person that we call a pilot, for lack of a better term, who is then able to redirect the vehicle if necessary or desired. Most of the time they don't, and then look at the data as it comes in, making sure that everything's working on board. There's no sense leaving it out there if it's, you know, not collecting the data you're looking for. So if there's a system that's broken, you can give it directions to stop at that point.
So how are they powered? How do they work? And then and how deep can they go?
So these are all powered by batteries. For the most part, lithium primary batteries, not rechargeable. They're much higher energy density. So, for instance, a Sea Glider can be at sea for 9 months on one set of batteries. And then we bring it in and we change the batteries, calibrate the sensors, and put it back out again for another mission. They all function using a force of buoyancy. So this is how they can use so little battery energy. They change the density of themselves relative to the water around them to go up and down in the water column. And that, combined with the wings, provides a forward direction, because as they sink the wings and they pitch forward, the wings grab the water and move them forward. And they are steered pretty simply as well. Most of them have almost no moving parts except this bladder that inflates and deflates in order to change the volume of the glider, which changes its density, because density is merely mass divided by volume. So the buoyancy engine is what gets them up and down through the water column, and they go to 1,000 meters, at least the Sea Glider and all of its brethren class. There were other gliders, Slocum gliders and Spray gliders, that came about at the same time, effectively. And these all are aimed at that upper 1,000 meters or 3,300 feet of the water, which sounds deep, but is nowhere near the bottom or even the average depth of the ocean, which is about 3,700 meters. So we've just come up at the University of Washington with what we're now calling the Deep Glider, and it goes to 6,000 meters deep using identical principles, and indeed, in fact, a lot of the design of the Sea Glider.
We'll talk more about the Sea Glider with Dr. Fritz Starr. You can join us here on the Jefferson Exchange. He is the manager of the Sea Glider Fabrication Center at the University of Washington School of Oceanography. Phone number here if you have questions or comments on topic, 800-838-3760. If you have questions or comments by email about sea gliders, jx@jeffnet.org. So how much more robust do you have to make a deep glider? I mean, it just sounds like a heavily armored kind of thing versus the Sea Glider itself.
Well, It turns out that we only added about 30 kilograms to the whole package. So instead of 50 kilograms, the thing weighs about 80 kilograms. And a lot of that is in the pressure hull. So instead of an aluminum pressure hull holding the water back from the batteries and all the electronics, we have a combination carbon fiber and aluminum pressure hull. So some of the extra mass is there. Some of the extra mass is in a compressible fluid we add that helps overcome the lack of compressibility of that carbon fiber. It's really stiff stuff. But it turns out that we basically designed a pressure hull using the same techniques that Boeing designed their 787 aircraft out of. And in fact, it's Boeing that turns the hulls for us. So a little combination of modern aerospace technology adapted to the underwater world, and away we go.
So let's talk about the kind of data that the sea gliders and the deep gliders will be bringing back, have been bringing back already. What are the things you're learning about the ocean that you didn't know?
Well, the primary data that they collect is temperature, salinity, oxygen concentration, and some other sensors, things like chlorophyll, fluorescence, and optical backscatter. So all electronic. But these are basic properties of the ocean physics and chemistry, and things that we're beginning to learn is how extensive the spread of the temperature that's going into the extra temperature that's going into the ocean, the extra carbon dioxide that's going into the ocean. We don't have a direct measure of that, but we can measure various proxies for that kind of thing. And with the deep glider, we're beginning to look at a part of the ocean that really hasn't been looked at in a very long time. We have very, very few measurements of the ocean below 2,000 meters. We're actually pretty well covered above that with the Argo Float program, another profiling AUV that drifts around and goes up and down in the water column every 10 days. But it's what's below that we are uncertain about in many ways, including how much, where a lot of this extra heat and carbon dioxide are moving within the ocean. So it's ocean circulation and properties thereof. Just last week at this meeting that I was at, there was a lot of very interesting work shown from ship data that was in the deep ocean that I think will be able to augment greatly with using a deep glider. And the sea gliders have done work in places that we've never been able to get to with a ship, like inside the polynya of an opening in the ice in the springtime in Antarctica, and underneath the edge of the ice up in the Arctic as that ice forms and breaks up. These are just places you can't get to with a ship. So, these are incredibly valuable tools for that type of research.
Is there any particular wear and tear that you do get on the sea gliders and the deep gliders? I mean, do they come back with some dents and dings or maybe shark chomp bites or something?
Yes, actually.
Really?
It turns out that our colleagues who fly these around Hawaii tend to suffer a fair number of shark attacks. And now we have gliders in the Red Sea, and those are suffering shark attacks as well. Not quite sure why the sharks in those places don't like the gliders, but...
They spit them out anyway.
They chew them up and they damage the sensors and sometimes the antennas and the wings. But for the most part, they come back. They come back and we can fix them up and put them out again. So,
have any been lost through reasons you don't know?
Oh yes, and most of the time when they do go lost, we really don't know why. Sometimes we have a few hints in the last data from the last few dives, but a lot of the time they just go off the air and you never hear from them again and you don't know why. That's part of the problem with, improving the design is there's no feedback sometimes on the failure mechanisms. So you have to guess. So it's taken a while to perfect them, partly due to that. So I would say in general, loss rate on gliders is probably around 10%.
Oh, that high? Okay, yeah.
Yeah, 10 to 20, depending on where they're being operated. I mean, obviously, the harsher the environment, the more likely they are to go missing.
We're talking about autonomous underwater vehicles, AUVs, particularly the sea gliders that come out of the Sea Glider Fabrication Center at the University of Washington School of Oceanography. Dr. Fritz Starr is in charge of that operation and our guest on the exchange. He'll be speaking tomorrow night at 7 at the Hale Center at SWOC in Coos Bay. You can join us now with questions or comments about underwater vehicles unmanned. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So, Fritz, have there been some whoa, that's unexpected moments when bringing in some of the data so far?
I'm sorry, there's unexpected moments?
I mean, have you been some revelations, some things that made you guys go, whoa, we didn't expect to see that?
Yeah, occasionally we, you know, there, for instance, we've had some of these deep gliders out in the Atlantic this past summer, and there were some big eddies that came through that were centered, you know, at about 1,200 meters deep, so actually below the level that a sea glider could have captured them at, but they had really strong bullets of low oxygen in the center cores, and then an evidence of, you know, sort of geostrophic evidence of the eddy actually going all the way down to the seafloor. So strong ocean motions that were, you know, you wouldn't otherwise see unless you had something out there all the time. And that's one of the things that's difficult about the ocean, is that we'd like to be everywhere all at once, but that's impossible. So, and you can't, you know, penetrate the ocean with satellite views. So the only way to do that is to either, you know, place a lot of infrastructure out there like moorings and or cables along the seafloor, or have, you know, autonomous vehicles profiling continually in various areas. So,
and how many autonomous vehicles are out there? I looked at the map, and there were dots all over it. It looked like all over the world.
Well, these are typically operated by individual agencies or scientists, as opposed to there is the Argo Float Program is a global program, with, I don't know, 3,900 floats out there right now, and they're truly scattered everywhere. It's hard, as far as where gliders are, it's hard at any one time to know who all has got them in the water, because they're now all over. You know, for instance, Australia owns about a dozen of them and probably has most of those in the water taking data for their scientists on a regular basis. The U.S. Navy owns about 80, maybe 100 of them, and, of course, they don't tell us where they are. You know, various PIs, we've got folks. Craig Lee at the University of Washington probably has 20, and at any given time he has, 10 of those in two or three different places in the world, like Taiwan or Davis Strait up near Greenland, or off the Washington coast. So there actually are quite a few gliders operating right off the Oregon coast, along and California or Trinity Head. There's a glider out there right now of ours that's being operated by Oregon State University, and off of Newport. There's a line of glider data that comes in all the time.
All right, so gliders all over the place. How much does it cost to make one of these, one of the sea gliders?
A sea glider is approximately $120,000 instrument, and the deep gliders are about $200,000. So, yeah, it sounds expensive until you realize that a day to take a research ship out is about $38,000. So,
and you wouldn't just go for a day, so that's going to
no.
get close in cost, of course, over time. Has there been lots of trial and error with the technology? I mean, lots of things that broke in the lab and testing, and pressure vessels that didn't handle the pressure, things like that?
Yes, we've gone through a lot of testing to improve things, but there's nothing like testing in the real world. So, you know, we thought we had our deep glider design all in hand, and we discovered in our deployments this past summer that there's one part of the design that's still not quite robust enough to do what we're doing. So we're in the process of working that out.
All right, so if you get into 6,000 meters, you're down around 20,000 feet, so there's still some ocean below where even the deep gliders can reach, it sounds like.
There are, yes, about 1.8% of the ocean floor is deeper than 6,000 meters. So if you can cover to 6,000 meters, you're covering, you know, 98% a little bit more than 98% of the ocean floor. For instance, where these have been working out in the Atlantic, the deepest part is 5,400 meters. So, you know, there's no problem getting all the way to the bottom and not getting close to crush depth. But if you go down to Puerto Rico, for instance, there's a trench there that goes down to like 9,000 meters. So you can't use this to get to the bottom of the Puerto Rico Trench. It's one of those. It's part of that 1.8% that's deeper than 6,000 meters.
Just a little bit still out of the reach. The way you describe the ocean, though, with its currents and things, I'm getting a much greater sense that this is a lot like the atmosphere and the jet stream and all the things that blow around above us, but this is just in a different direction.
It's correct, and the ocean circulates as robustly as the atmosphere does, but on a different time scale, on different time scales in general. So, you know, things that blow by, storms that blow by in the atmosphere in a matter of days, you might see a similar phenomena in the ocean, but it's going to last for months or years. The general circulation of the ocean, it's roughly 1,000 years for a parcel of water that, you know, may start off of Greenland to, you know, go deep and come back up and be circulated all the way back around. So the ocean circulation is a big flywheel on the atmospheric circulation as part of our climate.
All right. A very, very different rate of speed, as you point out, though. We're learning a lot about the ocean through the Sea Glider program and through the use of other autonomous underwater vehicles, or AUVs. Dr. Fritz Starr manages the Sea Glider Fabrication Center at the University of Washington School of Oceanography. You can catch him tomorrow night in person at the Hale Center at 7 o'clock at Southwestern Oregon Community College in Coos Bay. Dr. Starr, thanks so much for joining us today on The Exchange.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you for having me on.